program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Beautiful Monday, back home in Portland, Oregon, and finally a restful weekend, and back ready to go. Speaking of back and ready to go, the Bush administration ready to go on from Mr. Gonzalez, Alberto Gonzalez, announcing this morning that he is resigning effective September 17th. He wants to spend more time with his family and avoid indictment for perjury, I think, at the very least. And we will be going through in this program this morning and taking your calls on it and discussing it in general, frankly, throughout the full 3 hours of the program, even though we have a number of guests scheduled. It's the summer and we're getting some folks on here, but we will be going through some of the details on this. It looks like Chertoff is going to be replacing Gonzo, and that Clay Johnson III is going to be replacing Chertoff. And Clay Johnson III's one claim to fame is that he was George Bush's roommate at the prep school that he went to in Andover. So anyway, we'll get to that in a little bit. But first, Michael Chapman is with us. Michael Chapman is the managing editor over at the Cybercast News Service, a conservative news site on the web, cnsnews.com. And Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Matt Purple is writing over at your site about how Democratic candidates make their pitch to union workers. And actually, you know, the article that Matt wrote was fairly straight up. I mean, it was pretty much just solid reporting that the Democrats are reaching out to union folks. The flip side of this, of course, that Republicans by and large are reaching out to big corporate folks, although there's no shortage of Democrats doing the same. But my understanding is that you guys are of the opinion that the unions really should not be playing a role in the elections. Do I have that right?
No, not that they shouldn't be playing a role in the elections. It's just I would question, you know, to what extent unionized workers are as effectual or as necessary as they were maybe 30 years ago, 25 years ago in the workforce. But I mean, as far as
what is effectual
working in the elections, I mean, and you know, supporting candidates or not supporting candidates, that's perfectly fine. That's not something.
Well, that's I guess that's the point of your article there. At least Matt's article is that unions are becoming, he suggests, increasingly less relevant in America. I would submit to you that that's the consequence of a 27 year now war against organized labor. Really, it's a war that goes back, arguably, to 1947 with the passage of Taft-Hartley by conservatives, by and large by Republicans, but that certainly was declared full out by Ronald Reagan. And, you know, when Reagan came into office, a quarter of America's workforce was unionized, which meant half of Americans who are working had the kind of job that you get with a union, with a pension and full health care and enough money to put your kids through school and buy a home and a car. And now we're down to about 7% of the private workforce being unionized, and in the process, the middle class is being wiped out. I don't see how you can say that that's a good thing for America.
Well, I agree with you that that is the debate. You know, to what extent have unions been hurt over the last 25 years? But I would argue that a lot of the damage in terms of the growth of the unions and the declining growth has been self-inflicted. Unions have, to a large extent, pushed policies on companies and forced companies to raise wages, to put in conditions, working conditions, and so on, that a lot of the companies may or may not have been able to afford. And some companies had to cut back, some companies had to shut down. And at the same time, you've got this, whether we like it or not, we've got this globalization going on with the economy. And
well, that's the real issue. I mean, if a union says, you know, we're not going to work unless you pay us $18 an hour, and the company says, well, we can get this done in Mexico for $5 an hour, then the union's toast. And that's what's happened over and over again, which I guess leads us to the biggest question, you know, the real big picture question, is the economy here to serve the people and to serve the nation, or are we the people here to serve the economy, to serve corporate interests?
Well,
what's the priority?
No, that's a good question, and I would argue that the economy is here to serve consumers, to serve the American people. It is not here to serve. It's not here to serve.
I'm not talking about consumers. I'm talking about citizens.
It's not here to serve the unions either, because the unions, are, in many cases, are in bed with big business. And my view is that the American consumer reigns supreme. And if the American consumer can find an automobile, say he's got a budget of $10,000, and he says, well, the only car I can afford right now is this $7,000 car from Korea versus a $20,000 car from Detroit, the American consumer is free to choose. And
right. Well, first of all, you're characterizing Americans as consumers rather than as citizens, and I think that that's a horrible distinction to make.
They're citizens at the same time, but they're consumers.
Here's the question. Is it right for any business in the United States to operate in a way where its employees cannot live, basically? I mean, the vast majority of people who are uninsured or underinsured in the United States are employed. The vast majority of the people in the United States who are experiencing what the Bush administration euphemistically now refers to as food insecurity, used to be called hunger, where they literally don't know where the next meal is going to come from in the next 30 days, are employed. The vast majority of people in the United States who are having to make horrible choices between buying food or buying medication are employed. I mean, the majority of the poor in the United States are the working poor. Shouldn't we say, as we once did in this country, as we did for a long time in this country, that if you're going to operate a business, or if we are going to have trade policies, that business and those trade policies are going to work in a way that ensures that there actually is a healthy middle class?
Well, when you get into trade policies, I mean, there are a lot of variables involved there, and you can certainly debate those on whether or not what's good for the American citizen and the American consumer versus maybe what is good for big business or corporate interests. And I would argue, again, the policies should be in line with what is best for consumers who are also citizens. And unfortunately, you have a lot of corporate welfare.
But consumers are also employees.
Please let me finish. You have a lot of money coming out of the federal government going to big businesses in the form of subsidies and other handouts that go to these companies. And as a result of that, prices are kept artificially high, and consumers do not get the prices that they should get in a competitive open market.
I think the distinction in the questions that you're asking and that I'm asking is that you're saying what's best for consumers. In other words, how can we all get the cheapest price?
Well,
and I'm saying
if,
what's best for wage earners, because
all
of those consumers are also wage earners.
What's best for the guy going to the grocery store who has to choose between, you know, food or, extra help around the house or health care or child care for his fourth child? I don't know. I would argue, what is best for that guy at the grocery store.
But see, that's my point. I'm saying that we are wage earners first and consumers second. And I would much rather pay an extra buck for a pair of shoes at the, or an extra 20% for my groceries or whatever if my paycheck is 30% larger.
Right. Well, my view, again, is that companies, and there are companies that do this, voluntarily choose to pay their workers the wages that they decide upon to keep those workers there because they're the best people they can get at that price. Those companies that undercut their workers and undersell their workers are going to lose in the long run. But I think companies should do that voluntarily. I don't think
if they can get workers in other countries, they're not going to lose.
But I don't think the government should impose a one-size-fits-all on every single company and say you have to pay this wage, you have to provide these benefits, you have
Why
to
not?
Do these things, because a lot of those businesses can't afford it.
Brought us the minimum wage, the thing that brought us the 7-day work week, the thing that brought us good working conditions were unions. I mean, it was the power of organized labor. Without them, you've got kingdoms, you've got corporations, which are not democratic institutions. Unions are democratic institutions.
Well, I would argue, again, look at Microsoft, for example. It has created hundreds of millions of jobs around the world.
Which pays very
well. And it did it without unions. The biggest employer that has created so much for this country and for businesses, not just in personnel, but in products and services, they did it all without unions.
Well, okay, that's a whole another discussion, I guess, but okay. Michael Chapman, CNSNews.com. Michael, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
Good
job.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
toward the end there, I got stuck in a straw man argument. I am not advocating that everybody in the United States should be a member of a union, or that unions should be required, you know, union membership should be required in order to do a business. But I do believe, and I strongly believe, that the economy and those components of the economy, including businesses, should exist to serve the public good. And in fact, from the founding of this country until the 1880s, it was the law in every state until what's referred to as the charter mongering era, when the various states began competing against each other for the business of John Rockefeller after Ohio told him what he was doing was a violation of antitrust laws and they were going to throw him out of Ohio. He said, okay, what state is willing to change their laws to let me come in? And New Jersey and Connecticut and Delaware and New York got into a competition to change their laws, to make things legal that used to be illegal for corporations to do. That's referred to as the charter mongering era, because it involved changing corporate charters, changing the laws relating to corporate charters. And I would submit to you that since the 1880s and 1890s, we have had an economy in the United States with the punctuation, with the space from the mid-30s until the 1980, with that one progressive era there, the New Deal era. Outside of that, that since the 1880s, we've had an economy that, by and large, serves the interests of those who own the economy and not those who actually create it. Workers are creating wealth. Workers are creating profits. Workers are creating income. So, anyhow, that said, Attorney General Gonzalez is apparently going to be replaced by Michael Chertoff. Michael Chertoff, the guy who says he has a gut feeling that there's going to be another terrorist attack. Michael Chertoff, there have been a number of his own incompetence is legendary, shall we say. As they're noting over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, one of the most repeated criticisms of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez's tenure is that he continued to serve as Bush's lawyer rather than the nation's lawyer. He lacked independence, said Harry Reid. The media are reporting that Chertoff is going to replace Gonzo. Most recently, Chertoff was criticized for claiming he had a gut feeling the nation faced a heightened terrorist attack. As head of the agency overseeing FEMA, Chertoff was ultimately the guy responsible for the way we responded to Hurricane Katrina. And to this day, I mean, look at what's going on with that. So the entire thing is just an absolute mess. It's an absolute disaster. And this morning, CNN's legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin speculated that there were already very good signs for Chertoff's nomination. Now, we're already hearing speculation from people about, well, is Gonzo getting out of the way now because, in his opinion, if he gets out of the way, then Bush can do a recess appointment with somebody. I don't think that Chertoff, even though Chertoff has demonstrated some rather startling incompetence, particularly around the issue of Hurricane Katrina and New Orleans, I don't think that he'll have a problem, frankly, because he has been confirmed by the Senate before. And typically when the Senate's already confirmed somebody, unless that person just really, really blows it hugely, and I don't think there's that broad perception in America that Skeletor is, you know, a profoundly and terribly incompetent guy, although people who look carefully certainly tend to think that, I think. But anyway, we'll see. It's going to be an interesting few days here, interesting few weeks. But the news reports that are coming out now are that Chertoff is going to probably replace Gonzo on the 17th, and that the guy who's going to replace Chertoff, and this is where it gets very weird, is Clay Johnson III, the deputy director of the management of the deputy director for management at the Office of Management and Budget. Now, what are his qualifications? His qualifications are that he served as George Bush's chief of staff when Bush was governor of Texas, that he attended college with the president, and that he attended prep school with the president. And in fact, when Bush chose Johnson to be his chief of staff in Texas, this is what George Bush said to Clay Johnson III, you know, on the record, he told Johnson and his wife, Ann Sewell Johnson, over lunch. This is out there. This is, a matter of public record. In fact, it's archived over at Newsmax, one of the right-wing sites. He says, I want someone whose primary interest is me, George Bush, and who doesn't hope to parlay this into something and isn't trying to curry favor with this one or that one. In other words, Bush wants somebody who's number one, and obviously that's what Gonzalez has been all about. Gonzalez has been protecting Bush every step of the way. He has been acting as Bush's lawyer rather than as the nation's lawyer, which is his job, to be the nation's lawyer. And it's just, it's one more. Here we're going to have now a guy in charge of the Department of Homeland Security who has no experience in Homeland Security. None. No experience with immigration, no experience with air travel security, no experience with disaster response, nothing that has to do with the nation's defense. But he's loyal to Bush. So in he goes. Back with your calls right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Pain. 34 minutes past the hour, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com for our blog, and TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room or post over on our message boards. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I think the resignation of Alberto Gonzalez has the potential for being very, very significant. If you remember back during Watergate, I believe it was when Mitchell stepped down that the Democratic senators demanded that the new attorney general appoint an independent prosecutor to examine Watergate, which led to the impeachment of Nixon.
But that was already post, as I recall. I mean, I go back and look at the timeline, but my recollection is that was after they had succeeded in prying out some of the tapes, which demonstrated that Nixon had actually committed a crime, that he was actually involved with the Watergate cover-up. And Mitchell was just trying to get out of the way. He ended up going to jail anyway. We don't have that smoking gun yet because Gonzalez has so successfully kept it hidden. And there's no doubt in my mind that Chertoff won't do the same.
Well, are you still there?
I am.
Oh, okay.
And you are too.
In this case, I think it depends upon the senators. For example, to insist that there be an independent prosecutor to look into the firings of the U.S. attorneys, to look into the... where they tried to eliminate Democratic voters, I forget the name.
The caging, the Tim
caging,
Tim,
right.
Tim Cummings there, was involved in, and the U.S.
There are a number
scandal.
Of things that,
and the Senate is looking into all those things right now, and Henry Waxman and John Conyers, the House in particular, actually is where most of the most aggressive investigations are going on, and Waxman and Conyers are at the head of them, but... it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting. Julian, you raise an interesting point, and to the extent to which we're seeing Watergate repeated, I don't know. Well, it's
good morning, Tom.
Interesting times. Kyle in San Rafael, California. Good morning, Kyle.
And good morning to you on this historic Monday. I think all of us in the progressive community have great cause to celebrate, but I don't think that we can overlook the fact that we're dealing with someone who is resigning just ahead of what very well could be perjury charges
or impeachment. I don't think for the benefit of democracy in the United States and the integrity of our government,
yes,
it would have been better if Gonzalez had tried to hang in there and there had been an impeachment hearing or a prosecution for perjury, of a sitting attorney general, because then it would have gotten the attention that it needs and Americans would have gotten the civics lesson that they need.
What the Senate can really show now in the Judiciary Committee hearings is some spine, finally, from the Democrats and the concerned Republicans not to appoint and rubber stamp Chertoff. Now, you can make a case that he is a qualified applicant since he sat on the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals and since he was also an assistant attorney general in the Department of Justice. Nevertheless...
And a good buddy of Rudy Giuliani's.
Right. But despite that, His as you brought up earlier, his handling of the Katrina mess alone disqualifies him. And there are a lot of other reasons. At this point, we're looking at a fulcrum. The guy who's in this chair, the Attorney General, is going to be in charge of the investigations. And as Harry Reid says, these lead back to the White House. So the Democrats have got to pound the table over and over in these here in these upcoming confirmation hearings for a truly independent Attorney General. And if they don't, they're going to lose what little respect I have left for the Democratic Party in the last year and a half. I've been hoping for so many things to happen, including a defunding of the Iraq War. None of that's happened. Now is their chance to get to the bottom of it. And if they don't, they lose me as a Democrat. I go back to green or whatever else is out there.
No, I get it, Kyle, and I think they're going to lose a lot of people as well. Marjorie Cohn, who was on this program last week over at Truthout, wrote an op-ed piece calling for the prosecution of Alberto Gonzalez as a war criminal under Title 18 U.S. Code Section 2441, the War Crimes Act. She said that he should be prosecuted as a war criminal, and for specifically count one, application of the Geneva Convention's definition of torture, that Section 130 of the Geneva Convention, he breached it. Torture is willful killing, torture, or inhuman treatment, and willfully causing great suffering or serious injury to body or health. And Gonzalez actually wrote the memos that said that there was a, quote, new paradigm, end quote, and that the Geneva Conventions were, quote, quaint, end quote. Count two, military commissions. Alberto Gonzalez, you know, creating these kangaroo courts. This, again, violates Section 130 of the Third Geneva Convention that says you may not willfully deprive a prisoner of war of the rights of fair and regular trial prescribed by this convention. And that she's suggesting Alberto Gonzalez is a war criminal. And Professor Francis Boyle wrote another brilliant piece. He's a professor of law at the University of Illinois. Again, saying Article 129 of the Third Geneva Convention says each high contracting party shall be under the obligation to search for persons alleged to have committed or be ordered to be committed such grave breaches and bring such persons, regardless of their nationality, before its own courts. In other words, we, the United States, the offices of the United States, need to bring to account our own war criminals. And here we have some serious legal scholars saying that Alberto Gonzalez is, you know, not just incompetent and not just a guy who's been, you know, holding the home fires and covering up basically for George W. Bush like crazy, but that he's a war criminal. I have to say I agree with that. Sheila in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Sheila.
Hi there, Tom. Yeah, you know, so Gonzalez is...
Nope. We seem to have lost Sheila. Let's go to Rich in Altoona, Pennsylvania. Hey, Rich.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Hey, getting back to your guest there, I think we just need a change in corporate mentality, because instead of paying a CEO $250 million just for the simple thing of offshoring all the labor, why not give him a decent salary and bonus of, say, $5 million, put $245 million back into the company in wages and benefits?
Well, that's how it used to be, and the reason that it was that way was because there was a top income tax rate of 91% after you made $3.2 million a year. You started paying 91% income tax. And so, you know, CEOs at the very high end of the CEO wage range were making $3.2 million a year, and that left a lot of extra money in the company for things like decent wages. You're absolutely right, Rich. And the way to solve that problem is to go back to the income tax structure that we had under Eisenhower, that liberal Republican. Oh, my. 1-866-303-2270. Steve in Mountain View, California. Hey, Steve.
Good morning, Tom. It's good to see you in San Francisco on Friday.
Thank you.
Thanks for doing that. I appreciate that.
It was a pleasure being there, and that's Leonardo's movie is just awesome.
Yeah, that was awesome. So you and I are both old Michigan guys. I wanted to point out that I actually agree with unions in principle. They're basically a good thing, but I wanted to point out there has been an awful lot of devastation to the factory working community in southeast Michigan, and I think the unions had a lot to do with that. So I wanted to
because they were demanding high wages.
Well, no, not demanding high wages. You have to demand high wages. That's part of being able to make a living and support your family. The point I was making is that the unions got a little carried away, I think, intended to protect people who otherwise would have been dismissed. I knew personally of several families where the the guys were drunk or the guys were habitually late for work and they were protected by the union when they probably should have been let go. So there are some abuses
but
there on that
yeah,
side.
I know of, you know, situations like that. I mean, two of my three brothers are the equivalent of shop stewards in their unions, one in the printers union, one in the electricians union. And my dad, you know, worked in a union shop his entire life. I've been there and I've seen that. And
that's right.
And you're right. And it's a fraction of 1%. I mean, it's a fraction. It's tiny. I could give you a long list, and Steve, you make a good point, but I could give you a long list of things that are wrong with democracy as well. And yet, you know, the good outweighs the bad. The positives outweigh the negatives. And I think that's the bottom line. Errol in Greeley, Colorado. Hey, Errol.
Hello, Tom. I, along with 31,000 other people last year, was fired for trying to start a union. I was able to do something most people weren't. I was able to represent the working people of America. I stood next to Hoyer and Pelosi in the Congress when the Employee Free Choice Act passed. I testified before the Senate and Ted Kennedy on this issue. The company I was working for was absolutely heinous. They have fired several people that supported the union. They still continue not to drag their feet with a contract. They have violated every labor law you can imagine. Mike Chapman doesn't get the point. The decision is not up to the company. It's up to the worker whether or not we have a union. But unfortunately, with no labor law protection, the company manages to do exactly as they wish.
Well, we actually have the labor laws that provide the protection. The problem is that our Department of Labor, which is supposed to represent labor, ever since Reagan has been, you know, with a soft interlude during the Clinton years, but by and large, ever since Reagan, the Department of Labor has become an institution hostile to labor.
That's right, and
they refuse to enforce
the
laws. That's right. You're well said, Errol. Thank you very much for the call, and good on you for trying to start a union, and I'm sorry to hear that you lost your job for it. But you're right. Over 30,000 Americans lost their jobs last year simply because they stood up and said, I would like a union here in my place of work. And that's wrong. It's criminal, and we need to be enforcing, at the very least, those laws. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Tom told me when I was younger, said, boy, you're gonna be president, but just like everything else, those old crazy dreams.
Before the hour, 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Elliot Neistat is with us. He is a member of the Texas House of Representatives, representing the 49th District in the Texas House of Representatives. Elliot, thanks for dropping by the studio. Welcome.
Welcome. I'm glad I'm here.
Glad to have you with us. You were one of the Democrats who was fighting Roe's reapportionment efforts in Texas. One of your badges of honor is how many people in Texas hate you? For example,
well, there are quite a few. We could start with George Bush, Karl Rove, Karen Hughes, most importantly, Barbara Bush.
Now, why does Barbara Bush hate you?
When George Bush was governor, everybody knew he was planning to run for president, and so we had an agenda, and one of his agenda items was welfare reform.
Uh-huh.
And I chaired the Health and Human Services Committee during the George Bush reign of terror in Texas, and all of his punitive, harsh, draconian welfare reform bills, which would hurt kids and hurt families, went through the committee that I chaired, and somehow none of his bills made it out of that committee. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of publicity about that when he ran for president, that he basically lied about his record on Health and Human Services, saying that he passed all these bills, but he didn't. And Molly Ivins wrote about that in her book Shrub.
Mm-hmm. And you knew Molly Ivins?
Knew her very well, a close friend. We miss her dearly. And while the Supreme Court was determining that George Bush would be the next president, one of the local newspapers did a story. If Governor Bush loses the race for the presidency and returns to Texas as governor, who will he go after for revenge and retribution? And I'm proud to say I was number one on that list.
That's the top of the list. We're talking with Elliot Neistat, who is a member of the House of Representatives in the state of Texas. Elliot, very often, it's been a while, actually, since I've seen it in the mainstream press, but very often the White House gang is referred to as the Texas Mafia. I mean, you've got, obviously, Harriet Myers, some of the names that you just went through, Alberto Gonzalez, Gonzo, part of the Texas Mafia, Karl Rove, part of the Texas Mafia. You know all these guys. You know them personally. You've been up close and personal. You've fought them politically for two decades in the Texas legislature. What's your take on Karl Rove's resigning and, going to spend more time with his family? And what's your take on Alberto Gonzalez's resignation here?
Well, first of all, these are individuals who are absolutely loyal to George Bush and will do whatever they think he wants them to do or whatever he or Cheney tells them to do.
What's the source of that loyalty? Is it fear? Is it hope for future reward? Or is it just some ancient, genuine friendship?
I think it goes back to the history of fraternities in the United States. Mm-hmm. I think there is some fear in there, but it's the promise of what you can gain, of power and ultimately
being wealth. Part of the club.
Yeah. With Karl Rove, the word on the street in Austin, Texas, the capital, is that he's not coming back because of familial ties or reasons.
Well, his son is going off to college.
Senator John Cornyn, another George Bush loyalist, is up for re-election, and there are two serious Democrats who are duking it out to challenge John Cornyn. And the fear in the White House is that if John Cornyn doesn't get re-elected, it minimizes the chances that the Republicans can regain control of the United States Senate. So Karl Rove is being sent back to Texas to maximize the chances that John Cornyn, the United States Senator, will get re-elected in what will be a tough race. As far as Alberto Gonzalez, we always wondered in the Texas legislature, who is this guy? So he comes in as general counsel, and he does George Bush's bidding, gets him out of jury duty, where the now president would have had to fill out a form that stated that he did get convicted for a misdemeanor DWI.
Yeah. Well, he's our first president to have been convicted of a crime.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he really didn't want anybody to know that.
Mm-hmm. But with Alberto...
And Gonzalez covered it up.
Of course he covered it up, and he covered up other things. And to this day, Gonzalez, we mentioned congressional redistricting, mm-hmm. Tom DeLay coming down and trying to shove this down the throats of the legislature and 51 of us Democratic House members, knowing we didn't have the votes to stop it, using a legal mechanism, and that is breaking a quorum, leaving the state, going to Ardmore, Oklahoma, mm-hmm. shutting down government until the bell tolled and that bill couldn't pass and we became the killer D's. But ultimately, Alberto Gonzalez ends up Attorney General of the United States, and in that position, he oversees the Justice Department, and the Justice Department had to make a ruling on whether the congressional redistricting legislation violated the Voting Rights Act, and we know that all the senior attorneys in the Justice Department said, yes, it clearly violates the Voting Rights Act, and Alberto Gonzalez and his people said, we don't care. We're going to say that it's constitutional.
Whoa.
And they did. And
so
they did.
He pushed it through in
at the national level.
At the national level.
Absolutely.
He ratified a Texas law that all of the attorneys. Wow, that's incredible. It's not incredible. It's what a surprise. The Republican Party, it seems, increasingly at the national level is operating like a national mafia, like an organized crime organization. Frankly, I understand during Lyndon Johnson's era, the Democratic Party was not unlike that in Texas. The Republican Party is very much like that in Texas now. Would that be a reasonable, reward their friends, punish their enemies?
The Republican Party has taken this to new extremes. Texas has a history, Texas government, of being bipartisan, even going back to when LBJ was there, although the Democrats were in control.
Yeah.
But now bipartisanship is gone at the state level, just as it is at the national level.
Yeah. So as goes Texas, so goes the nation, at least with the Texas Mafia in the White House.
Unfortunately, that's the way it works.
Elliot Neistat, he's representing the 49th District of Texas and one of the killer D's. Good on you, Elliot. Thanks for dropping by. It's real nice to meet you.
Much.
57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, Kenny Ossibel from Bioneers will be talking about what we can do to save the world and your phone calls. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Alberto Gonzalez leaving. Chertoff in. Tobin in. Well, we'll see. We'll see. It's interesting times. Interesting times we live in. Leonardo DiCaprio has a new movie out, The 11th Hour. I remember when Bill O'Reilly was relentlessly flogging The Passion of the Christ on his TV show for the better part of a half a year. And it later turned out that he was a major investor in it and made a pile of money on that movie. I am not an investor in The 11th Hour and don't make a penny off it. In fact, quite to the contrary, I have been doing a lot of travel and whatnot on my own nickel. And the same is true of Kenny Ossibel, our next guest with Bioneers. In fact, really, this is Leo's effort, and I have a feeling it's a labor of love, as much as anything else. And we're talking about it not because we have hopes of great financial returns like Bill O'Reilly was, but rather because we have hopes that we can save this world before it goes down in flames. Kenny, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm just great. Kenny Ossibel is the co-founder, along with his wife Nina, of Bioneers. Bioneers.org is the website. Bioneers is this extraordinary conference that happens every fall in San Rafael, is it, Kenny?
Yes, San Rafael, just north of San Francisco, October 19th to the 21st.
And gets broadcast by satellite to secondary sites all over the world, literally. And I've spoken there at I think two out of the last two or three times. I forget how many, but it's just an extraordinary conference. And you're one of the major players or one of the major stars in this movie. You set it up and you wrap it up. And I wanted to get you on the line and just. Get your thinking, particularly since at Bioneers, which is where the movie started. The movie began. I guess this is where the idea for the movie began. Was at Bioneers. That you guys have in your conference the people who are doing some of the very best jobs of identifying the problems and some of the very best jobs of solving the problems. So let's start out with identifying the problems. This goes way beyond global warming.
Well, sure. I mean, the litany is well known to too many of us, but, you know, the crash of biological diversity, the very web of life on which our own lives depend. You know, the great microbiologist Lynn Margulis has said that she studies microbes and bacteria, and she said that perhaps the real purpose of human life on Earth is that we're such great hosts for the bacteria, you know, that they were here long before us and will be here long after us. And, you know, we face massive freshwater shortages, the crash of ocean marine life, and, I mean, the list goes on, and people are too familiar with the litany, so.
Yeah, in the movie, well, a lot of people aren't, actually, and I think it's worth, you know, revisiting. One of the points made in the movie was that 90% of the cells in our bodies are not human cells. They're things that we are hosting.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And one day I believe Lynn Margulis, the microbiologist, will probably win a Nobel Prize for her work, but where she has the theory of endosymbiosis. And basically her proposition is that billions of years ago there were these warring tribes of two kinds of bacteria, and neither was able to exterminate the other one, so they surrendered to the urge to merge and learned instead to cooperate. And that's where multicellular life came about as we know it, which, of course, led up eventually to human beings, who are fantastically complex organisms that harbor
all the life of the planet going back to the origins.
Right, and we are, and we are full of fungi and bacteria and viruses and all kinds of you know, hundreds of millions of other organisms, probably the vast majority of which we haven't even begun to identify. I mean, I saw a statistic the other day that there's over 450 known bacteria in the gut, of which fewer than 100 are even named so far.
We know so little, Tom, about the tree of life, the web of life. We were pretty clueless, to be honest. So we have a lot to discover. But what we do know is that after 4 billion years of R&D, life works, and there are no recalls in nature. If it doesn't work, it's gone, you know. So as I said, go ahead.
Well, which brings us directly to the E word, which is used in this movie, The 11th Hour, Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, and that is the extinction of human life on Earth. This is, I think I once said, this movie picks up where Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth leaves off. The extinction of human life on Earth?
Well, it's entirely possible. This is what's known as the sixth great era of extinctions, and there were five previously. About 99.9% of the species that have lived before us are gone. This is not uncommon. What's different in the sixth great extinction crisis is that for the first time it's actually caused by human beings. And that's a very different proposition. And the truth is that the Earth will survive just fine. It's just not on a human time frame. It would take about 10 billion years about 100 million years to reinstitute the scale of diversity that we know in the world today. So it'll happen. It just won't be on our time frame. And, you know, human beings are incredibly adaptable. So my dear friend and teacher, the late John Mohawk, has said, you know, people will survive one way or the other. It's a question of what kind of world we're going to survive in. It could be, you know, even lesser than Road Warrior.
Right, and the kind of society that we're going to have as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the fascinating things that I learned when I was doing the research for Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, a book I wrote on these topics back about a decade ago, was in reading Peter Farb's brilliant ethnography of the first contact with Native American societies. And he chronicles, you know, dozens of individual societies across the United States, and that over and over and over again, what he and others since then have found is that many of the most egalitarian, peaceful, and ecologically appropriate societies on Earth got that way because they had experienced crashes. They had experienced the absolute destruction of their own environment at their own hands.
It doesn't really solve the problem if you slow down to 55. We need to change directions, and we need to do it immediately. Some people give us 5 years, some give us 10. We don't know. You know, the next 5 years, I think we're going to see all kinds of serial collapse of one sort or another. And, you know, the point is, we know we need to change. Why wait? We need to stop and turn around now.
So in the 2 minutes or so that we have left here, what are the changes that need to be taken? This is more than just replacing the light bulbs in your house.
Oh, I think part of what I appreciate so much about the film is they don't really pull punches. They recognize that government policy is pivotal. You know, you look at most of the great fortunes in the world, and they were made directly because of government policies and subsidies and all of those kinds of things. So why spend $30 billion a year on the oil, gas, and nuclear industries, which are mature industries? If they can't make it without corporate welfare at this point, then let them fold, you know. But we should be subsidizing the transition to renewables immediately on a very large scale. And we need to create green-collar justice. I mean, poverty is one of the main causes of environmental destruction in the world today, a world where half the people live on $2 a day or less. So we need to create a huge job creation engine that's going to also bring about justice and reduce the only Gulf War we should be focused on is to end the gulf between rich and poor. So all the issues, a lot of what Bioneers talks about is that it's all connected. It's not just the web of life that's infinitely interconnected. It's all the issues are interconnected. And that was probably the biggest influence that we had on the film, was to tip it in the direction of solutions. So the latter third of the movie really focuses on the kind of solutions that the Bioneers are promoting, which work. I mean, in 90% of the problems that we face, we know what to do right now with state-of-the-shelf solutions, things that we already have. So
right.
There's things we need to figure out and things we still need to invent, and there's tremendous prosperity that resides there. But hey, we already know what to do. It's a matter of having we have intention deficit disorder. That's the main
thing. There you go. Pioneers.org is Kenny Ausubel's organization. The 11th Hour, film.com, 11th, and 11thhouraction.com. Two great websites. Kenny, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Yeah, the year that Ronald Reagan declared war on the working people of the United States. I have some nostalgia for 1981 as well, or at least the times before it. But we can bring them back. We can turn this country back into a country that works of, by, and for Americans, not just transnational corporations. From the news wires, as we like to introduce our Borowitz report, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez resigned today, effective immediately, telling reporters that he wanted to spend more time eavesdropping on his family. Mr. Gonzalez, a champion of domestic surveillance and warrantless wiretaps while in office, said he was totally stoked about turning his prying eyes on his own family. Domestic surveillance begins at home, Mr. Gonzalez said at a White House press conference. That means nobody in my family is above suspicion, not even the little ones. An apparent reference to Mr. Gonzalez's children. Standing by Mr. Gonzalez's side, President George W. Bush praised his former attorney general, singling out his courage for ramping up his domestic spying program on his own family. If every head of household, said Mr. Bush, was as willing to eavesdrop on his own family as my man Alberto is, we wouldn't need a Homeland Security Department. Mr. Gonzalez was noncommittal when a reporter asked him a question about the role that waterboarding and other forms of torture may play in his interrogation of family members. Nothing, he said, is off the table. That, of course, from Andy Borowitz at BorowitzReport.com, with permission. It's just great. And, you know, I mean, there's some really cool stuff out there and some kind of crazy stuff out there. Our crazy alert for this is actually sort of not crazy in a way. So, over at TrueMajorityAction.org, a grassroots citizens lobbying group that was started by, as I recall, Ben Cohen of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream. A political science professor from Middlebury, Vermont, has won basically the office pool. Now, 36,000 people nationwide entered the office pool, but the office pool was to guess the date and time that Alberto Gonzalez is going to resign. And the prize is a year's worth of Ben & Jerry's ice cream, 50 pints of premium ice cream. And the professor correctly picked, actually he was off by 20 minutes, came within 20 minutes of the exact time that Gonzalez would publicly announce his resignation. Matt Holland, who's the executive director over at TrueMajorityAction.org, said, "It's an important moment. My own prediction was that Gonzalez would be gone months ago, but any day that an opponent of the Constitution and international law leaves town is a good day." And TrueMajorityAction.org members, of course, had been opposing the confirmation of Gonzalez right from the very beginning, repeatedly urging their members of Congress to oppose his policies. And beginning this morning, they note, these same grassroots activists are calling on Congress to only confirm a new attorney general who promises to restore civil liberties curtailed under Gonzalez. So, good on him. Good on him and his year of ice cream, as I already mentioned. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Roger, Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Roger, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Bernie Sanders' state is the only state that Mr. Bush hasn't visited in his presidency.
Yeah.
And also, I'd like to ask if Mr. Gonzalez and Mr. Rove, after returning to civilian life, are they still, can they still be prosecuted? I know there was talk of...
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, they can still be prosecuted. They can't be impeached, but they can still be prosecuted. The question is, will they still be prosecuted? And that's going to be a, you know, a question about the will and the spine of Congress on the one hand. And on the other hand, frankly, a lot of members of Congress are going to be facing dual agendas. I mean, they've got budget bills to pass. They've got laws that need to be, that need to be passed. You know, a huge appropriations bill coming up. There's a lot of stuff that Congress needs to attend to. The question is, does this Congress think that they can chew gum and walk at the same time? So far, for example, with respect to impeachment, they've been saying, no, we can't chew gum and walk at the same time. So, you know, the question, will they prosecute Gonzalez? Will they prosecute, and, you know, will they go after him now, for, at the very least, lying to Congress? Time will tell. Time will tell. And Chertoff, Skeletor, of course, if, assuming that he is the replacement, I'm sure will continue in the same tradition. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, about a minute to go before we got to take a break at the end of the hour. What's up?
I think the Democrats are a joke. They think they can out-distort and out-deceive the slimy Republicans we replaced, and it's just not going to happen. And I'll tell you, they're proud of themselves. Tom, they raised the crappy minimum wage, 25 cents an hour. Inflation's already eroded that since Bush has been in by 300%. And then they want us to all embrace 25 million illegal people in this country that's driving down the wages of the working class and bankrupting the country further with welfare and social benefits.
Yeah, well, your point, there is a lot of, I think your point, Armin, is that there's a lot of anger being directed at the Democratic Party, and frankly, I suspect that the majority of it is that many of us felt that they were elected to end the war in Iraq, and they didn't. And it should have been ended a year ago, and now instead it's going to be ended, in all probability, or wound down just in time for the elections to help the Republicans. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
JJ, the resignation of Attorney General Gonzalez, long overdue. This is from Nancy Pelosi. The remnant I can't pronounce that. You know what I mean. Of law, federal law enforcement. So this is Nancy Pelosi's statement. This is actually extraordinary. She's taking a very, very strong position, at least the words coming out of her mouth right now. The rampant politicization of federal law enforcement that occurred under his tenure seriously eroded public confidence in our justice system. She says the president must now restore credibility to the office of the attorney general, given the serious loss of public trust and the disarray at the Department of Justice. The American people must have absolute confidence in the integrity of the next attorney general as the nation's chief law enforcement officer and as defender of our Constitution, independent of political influence. And then she goes on to say, the nominee must also pledge. Now, keep in mind, she's the head of the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives does not have to vote on, it's the Senate that votes on confirmation of the new attorney general. So she can, I guess, talk is cheap, but it's not, you know, Harry, because Harry Reid is I'll give you his quote in just a second. He's not going as far as Pelosi is, but she says the nominee must also pledge to cooperate with ongoing congressional oversight into the conduct of the White House in the politicization of federal law enforcement. Hearings on the nominee will provide Congress with another opportunity to examine the new flawed FISA law and will aid in our efforts to improve it. Now, I would go a step farther, and in fact, there's a post over at the Daily Kos calling for this, and just say, this administration, if they're going to put somebody in as attorney general, number one, it should be somebody who has experience in law enforcement at the federal level, and number two, somebody who has never been a political appointee and has no political background or long personal history with George W. Bush or Dick Cheney. We've seen enough crony capitalism, we've seen enough crony politics, we've seen enough organized crime style politics being done in the White House enough already. Now, here's what Harry Reid said. Now, and it's the Senate that's going to have to confirm Gonzo's successor. He says Alberto Gonzalez was never the right man for this job. He lacked independence, he lacked judgment, and he lacked the spine to say no to Karl Rove. This resignation is not the end of the story. Congress must get to the bottom of this mess and follow the facts where they lead into the White House. Yeah, well said. By the way, George Bush is heading up to Washington State, the 8th District of Washington State, where Dave Reichert, the Republican congressman, is in deep trouble. And, looks like there's a very good chance that he will lose to Darcy Burner. And so over at Act Blue, and again, you find the link. In fact, Coase put it up over at the Daily Coase. It's W-8-3000. The Burn Bush effort started Saturday morning Pacific time with 1,253 contributors across all of Act Blue. We were at 1,567. 48 hours later, the numbers were 1,683 and 2,161, et cetera. The goal for today, as Bush takes his sorry butt to Seattle to campaign for Dave Reichert, is a cool 3,000 contributors for Darcy Burner across all of Act Blue. So you can get over to that at dailycoase.com. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Brian in Redondo Beach, California. Hey, Brian.
Good morning, Tom. I just want to say real quick, Alberto Gonzalez resigning is a direct result of when the people come for you, you have no other choice but to go. You have to go. And I want to encourage us to continue to write and continue to call and continue to do the things that we're doing by protesting. And do not be afraid of these people.
Yeah,
we
absolutely.
Have the power. We are the ones with the power. We are the deciders. We make the decisions.
Yep, it's called a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic. It's what we've got, and you're absolutely right. And we, the people, are getting stirred up and are getting active and are getting mobilized, and I agree with you. The reason Gonzo stepped down is because the people were paying attention. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph.
Yeah, Tom. It's interesting that Bill Riley was connected with Passion of the Christ, because everything in the Passion of Christ that was done to Jesus, according to Antonio Gonzalez, is totally legal. I mean, Gonzalez's standard is, it ain't torture if it's only pain equivalent to organ failure or death. Below that, it's legal. Think about this.
That's a tragic analogy, but yeah.
Yeah, but if Pontius Pilate had a crash cart on Golgotha, so Christ didn't die, everything in the Passion of the Christ, according to Gonzalez, can be done to any American.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And, yeah, it really is. Ralph, thanks for sharing a thought-provoking comment with us. Dave in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Fan of the show. Almost always with you on social issues, but I guess I'm going to appeal to your ethical sense on your advocacy for just like such strong government intervention relating to CEO pay. Your comment earlier on the income tax over $3 million. I mean, wouldn't that basically have the government deciding how a private company is going to allocate its profits?
Well, the government's already deciding how a private company is going to allocate its profits. Right now, it's illegal for a private corporation to deduct from their taxes CEO salaries of over $1 million.
Right, but I mean, isn't that a problem to a degree if we're just strengthening that even more? I'm talking about being reminiscent of a little bit of socialism here to a degree.
Yeah, I don't see a problem with it, Dave. I really don't. If my guide is simply history. If you look at the time, From the early 40s until 1982, when the top income tax rate in the United States was either 91% or 71%, and you look at that period of time, what you see is that no dynasties emerged, and yet business grew solidly. People became rich, people became millionaires, but you didn't see the creation of billionaires and multi-billionaires, and you also didn't see the creation of enormous and vast poverty. Instead, you saw the building of the strongest middle class that the world had ever seen. And that middle class started being deconstructed when we did away with the top income tax rate, in my opinion.
You're just saying a push for a closer degree between the rich and the poor, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I am saying right out front what the cons accuse liberals like me of saying, which is that I think that the government should be involved in social engineering. I think that there is a time and place for government to do that. The simple reality is government does it all the time, and even those cons who are saying, oh, the government should not have social engineering at all, they want to be sure that private corporations have limitations of liability, that corporations have rights, that there's thousands of miles of pages of rules and regulations that help corporations and that don't help you and me. You know, patent laws, trademark laws, they say they want free trade, but they want to restrict the ability of other countries to make things that happen to be owned by Disney, for example, or whatever. I mean, you know, pick the company. It's a very, very selective process. And I'm saying, fine, okay, we've got these zillion rules out here, and corporations are creatures of government. If you start a business and you just do it as a sole proprietorship, you're taking on all the responsibility and all the liability. I have, no problem with that. Most people choose not to do that. Most people choose to incorporate. And to incorporate, you have to go to a state and say, in exchange for doing certain things, I want certain things, I would like it if you, the state, would give me limitation of liability, the ability to deduct from my taxes, expenses associated with the business, even things like meals. And, I mean, there's just a whole bunch of benefits that we give to corporations. If we're going to give all those benefits to corporations, the opportunity to use our public infrastructure, to use our commons, and to operate and to do business in America, I think it's entirely appropriate for us to say to those businesses, and by the way, you're going to have to do it in a way that's appropriate for we the people. And as far as tax law goes, what we have seen is that John Maynard Keynes was right, that when you have a high top income tax rate, it causes people to say, yeah, I'll work really hard for $3 million a year or $4 million a year. And if I'm not going to make much more than that, that's fine. I'll put that money back into the company and I'll pay my employees better. And that's exactly what happened. And once Reagan kicked that top tax rate down, then, in the name of trickle-down economics, in the name of voodoo economics, in the name of supply-side economics that George Herbert Walker Bush called voodoo economics, saying, well, if the rich get richer, it'll trickle down. It didn't trickle down. The rich have gotten richer and richer and richer. And so, Dave, thanks for the call. I'm starting to get redundant here, so we'll move along. Suzanne in Albuquerque, New Mexico, about a minute before we got to take a break. Suzanne, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's great to talk to you. Thank you for helping me keep my sanity all these years. I'm celebrating Gonzo going away, and here they're having a protest. People are wearing PJs, pajamas, because Bush is visiting and raising money for Senator Menachie, who has been slumbering when it comes to working families' rights. And I want to say, as a healthcare worker, we work like robots. We work so hard, and doctors work so hard, and yet CEOs work hard too, but they run off with a $1 billion profit. And what can we do about that?
Well, it's the rules of the game. The rules of the game have been reconfigured. For example, in the healthcare industry, back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, if you were going to open a hospital, by law, it was required in most states for it to be a not-for-profit corporation. So the first goal of that hospital was to provide health care, not to provide profits. If you were going to run a health insurance company, Blue Cross Blue Shield was not-for-profit in almost all states by law. And it's simply a matter of saying we the people are going to set the rules of the game. You set the rules of the game so that the game is played in a way that provides good health care benefits, or that, nurses can't work over a certain number of hours. Okay, you're going to have to hire some extra nurses. And then you're going to provide it better. I mean, we do it with pilots. You say that, we don't want fatigued pilots. Do you want fatigued nurses? No. By the way, C-SPAN this Friday, where this show will be live, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
I have just an incredible clip of John Edwards I want to share with you right after the news at the top of the hour. And Louise and David and I are having a debate here about whether I should get a haircut for C-SPAN on Friday. Speaking of John Edwards, I don't know. I'm inclined to look long-haired and sloppy. We'll see. Ellen Ratner's on the line with us from the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, I don't need to tell you about Gonzo going away and the fact that it looks as if Chertoff might get that job. And, of course, Chertoff is a loyal soldier, good responsibility for Katrina, if I must say. But the guy I'm really concerned about is the fact that if Chertoff goes, they may nominate Clay Johnson, who's deputy director of Office of Management and the Budget. And you know those glossy catalogs you get, Horchow Collection? Well, and Mr. Johnson has been head of the Horchow Collection and Neiman Marcus mail order companies. He also was chief of staff for the president when he was governor of Texas and ran his transition team. But Homeland Security, I just don't see it.
Yeah, so this is a guy who has absolutely no experience in Homeland Security whatsoever. And I still, the word homeland creeps me out, but, you know, whatever. He has no experience in aircraft security. He has no experience in anti-terrorism. He has no experience in law enforcement. He ran a high-end catalog company, a direct mail company, and he was a loyal Bushy when Bush was governor. And that's, you know, once again, what we're seeing is that loyalty to George Bush trumps everything else. And this is something that typically you don't see in politics, you don't see in corporate America, you only see it in the mafia.
Well, for sure. And, of course, the president talked about what's so interesting is he talks about Gonzalez. He talks about his integrity, decency, and principle, being a man of principle. And then he talks about how he went after Internet predators, et cetera. Well, yes, the Justice Department has done that. Actually, I know a guy that's an older man in jail for that, and I don't even consider him an Internet predator. But the other thing, of course, anybody in the Justice Department will tell you is they are huge on sexual trafficking in terms of state to state. I don't mean United States. I mean country to country sexual trafficking. Mm-hmm. And this is what that's the imprint he's put on the Justice Department.
Alberto Gonzalez?
And Gonzalez and Bush through Bush.
Yeah.
Which is
a terrible thing, but I mean, is...
There's a lot of things the Justice Department ought to be concerned about.
Yeah, yeah, and we could put corporate crime on the top of that list. We could put terrorism. We could put violent crime. Not to say that sexual trafficking outside the United States is not violent crime, but let's look at within our country and solve some of these problems first.
The other thing I wanted to talk a little bit about is this 24-hour war room that the Pentagon's going to put together right in time for the report that is going to come out, the Petraeus report. And, in fact, one of my friends is sort of the point guy for the Iraq war for the White House. Very, very talented guy. He's on the dark side, what can I say? But he is certainly somebody that most likely suggested this Iraqi war room idea. Mark Feifle used to be at the RNC, as I said, extremely talented spinmeister, one of the most talented guys that you can imagine. But this is going to be an all-court press, and you just watch it in about a week. And it's also going to start tomorrow with the Veterans of Foreign War speech in Reno, Nevada, that the president will be making. And it's going to be very much focused on if this war is not straightened out, then we will not have Mideast peace. Of course, we haven't had Mideast peace for almost 2,000 years, but if the war does not go the right way, that isn't going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And go ahead.
And the other thing that's fascinating is, and I think it was in the Drudge Report, but it was a Financial Times reporting that the Saudis are going to be training these 35,000 people, actually trained by an American company, to watch their oil wells. And this is really because the Saudis have figured out that their biggest problems are the internal, essentially their own internal insurgency, and people in their own
The Shia within Saudi Arabia. The oil field, the region of Saudi Arabia, which is where all the oil is actually majority Shia. It's very lightly populated. So the country itself is a majority Sunni country, and the government is Sunni, and the Saudi royal family is Sunni. But in those regions where the oil fields are actually located, the majority of the indigenous population is Shia, and they're very concerned about that.
And the reason they want American training is to try and weed out, not that we're good at it, who might be, insurgency, et cetera, et cetera. Because they want sort of another hand in the training, the internal training of these people to watch the oil wells.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think we forget at our own peril is that Osama, to the extent that Osama bin Laden was or may have been responsible for 9/11, or certainly was responsible for a series of attacks on U.S. facilities around the world, we know that for sure. It was in large part to try to change U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia. He was opposed to our support of what he viewed as a corrupt regime that controlled the Holy Land. Saudi Arabia, there's this real, they're our enemy and they're our friend. And it's like, which way is this thing going to go down?
Well, that's correct. Well, also, of course, in terms of the support of the Saudis and the corrupt regime, this all started because we started to put bases there around the first Gulf War. And that's when they just got their backs up.
Yeah. That was one of Osama bin Laden's two demands. Was he said back in 98 that he was going to hit us if we didn't A, pull our soldiers out of the bases in Saudi Arabia, and B, raise the price of oil up to the point where we were not stealing the riches of the Holy Land. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on air. You are listening to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
In just a moment, Radley Balco is going to be with us about the militarization of our police departments. But first, I've got this clip. I just have to share it with you. This is John Edwards from a speech I believe he was giving yesterday. I'm not sure where. It's a YouTube clip that's, virally running around. It's over at the top of democraticunderground.com right now. And this is just a small piece of it, but it is really speaking to the point that I think is so important.
I want to go one step further. Because it is also time for my party, the Democratic Party, the party of the people, to end it. The choice for our party could not be any clearer. We cannot replace a group of corporate Republicans with a group of corporate Democrats. Woo! Just swapping the Washington insiders of one party for the Washington insiders of another is not what we need. The American people deserve to know that their presidency is not for sale, the Lincoln bedroom is not for rent, and lobbyist money can no longer influence policy in the House or the Senate. It is time for us to make a clear statement about who we are as a party. It is time to end this game. It's time to tell big corporations and their lobbyists who've been running things for too long that their time is over. It's time to challenge politicians to put the American people's interests ahead of their own calculated political interests. To look the lobbyists in the eye and just say no.
Yeah, look the lobbyists in the eye and just say no. Radley Balco is with us. He is the senior editor for Reason Magazine, the libertarian magazine, Reason.com, the website. And Radley, welcome to the program, first of all.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm pleased to have you here. And I suspect that in the realm of politics and economics and business and whatnot, there are many things that we could debate and perhaps in the future will, but right now I wanted to get you on because your testimony and your writings about SWAT teams in the United States, some of this research that you undertook on behalf of the Cato Institute, the libertarian think tank in Washington D.C., is truly shocking. 800 times a week in the United States? 800 times a week in this country. What happens?
800 times a week in this country, a SWAT team basically kicks down someone's door and storms the house and throws people on the ground, puts guns to their heads, and rummages through their belongings. And the really thing about this is that the vast majority of these raids are for nonviolent drug crimes, mostly. Most of those are for marijuana offenses, but, there is a legitimacy for SWAT teams, I think, but I think that use is limited to situations where you have someone who is an immediate threat to the community. So you're talking about hostage takings or bank robberies, escaped fugitives. But when you're looking at a nonviolent drug offender, somebody who's not really a threat to anyone, and you send somebody into their home and you kick their door down in the middle of the night, you're creating a violent situation. You're not defusing one, which is what SWAT teams were supposed to be for.
Right, and you point out that fewer than half of these 800 home crashes a week where they destroy the door and bust into the house and throw people to the floor, fewer than half of them even end up with the suspects being charged with felonies, and only a small percentage of those people end up doing any significant time in prison. We're not talking about a major problem across the United States of crime that is being responded to with a major push of militarization of the police. Instead, we have a problem. And you point out that over 40 Americans have died as a consequence of these SWAT attacks. And in every case, they were completely innocent. They got the wrong house.
Yeah, there are 40 cases of completely innocent people getting killed in one of these raids just over about the last 20 years. And the most recent one, I guess, was with the Katherine Johnston raid, the 92-year-old woman in Atlanta met. The cops broke down her door, and she thought she was being robbed, and she met them with a gun, and they opened fire and killed her. That case, the cops then handcuffed her and threw her on the floor and allowed her to bleed to death while they planted marijuana in her basement to cover up their mistake. There are about 40 cases I found, about 60 to 70 cases where you're talking about someone who probably wasn't completely innocent, but who was guilty only of a nonviolent drug crime. So there are cases where you had, the police said in the warrant that these were extremely dangerous people, big time drug dealers, and somebody believes they're being robbed, they get shot and killed, and the police find maybe a few grams of marijuana or a few grams of cocaine, but clearly this wasn't the violent offender that was described in the search warrant. So there are even more of those. And then there are lots of cases where police officers have been killed. One case that I've been reporting on for a couple of years now and following pretty closely is the case of Corey, Mississippi, where you have a 20-year-old black guy who has no prior criminal record at all, had less than a gram of ash and marijuana in the house, and the police kicked his door open in the middle of the night. Maybe had the wrong house. There's still some question about that. But this guy, he had no record. He had a minuscule amount of marijuana. He probably wouldn't have even been charged. At worst, it would have been a misdemeanor. Thought he was being invaded, robbed, shot one of the police officers and killed him, and was convicted of capital murder and sentenced to death. There are so many things wrong with these raids. I mean, just from a symbolic standpoint, the idea that homes are being invaded 800 times a week in this country at least,
By what seems to be a paramilitary force rather than a police force. And you point out that this all goes back to the Reagan era and laws passed by Congress and President Reagan and presidents since then, basically, that have turned surplus military equipment over to local police departments and thus turned our domestic civilian police departments into domestic civilian essentially army forces.
Yeah, and that's a huge problem. I mean, in this country, we have a history of drawing a very distinct line between civilian police forces and military forces, and there's a good reason for that. The military is trained to annihilate a foreign enemy, to kill people and break things, basically. We ask something very different of our police officers. They're supposed to uphold our rights, and they're supposed to protect our constitutional rights while they fight crime. And when you start to blur that line, you get into some pretty dangerous territory. And I think, you know, when you're giving local police departments military equipment, military guns, tanks, helicopters, all from the Pentagon, you're training these SWAT teams. They're trained lots of times by, you know, Navy SEAL, Army Ranger, military forces. Then you go out and tell them they're fighting a war on drugs. And we shouldn't be surprised when we get some of these results, when some of these SWAT teams sort of act like they're on a battlefield instead of on our city streets, and they treat American citizens like enemy combatants instead of, you know, of people with rights.
So is this the consequence of what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about, the military-industrial complex looking for new customers for their products? They can sell more and more stuff to the Pentagon, and then the Pentagon can dispose of some of that stuff by giving it to local police departments. Is this, you know, obviously somebody's making some good bucks here?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, now if you go to some of these SWAT conventions, you'll see that a lot of the military outfitters are marketing directly to police departments, and I think that you're seeing that now. But I think it evolved that way because I think in the 80s, starting, I guess, going back to the Nixon administration, but really during the 80s under the Reagan administration, you saw this increase in military language, military symbolism, a much more militaristic approach to the war on drugs. And I think that the huge thing was this Pentagon surplus program. And, you know, I mean, the Pentagon isn't making any money from this. Most of these police departments for free, or at most at, you know, a huge steep discount, 80 or 90% off what the Pentagon paid for it. So, yeah, I don't think that there was any sort of coordinated campaign where these military outfitters were lobbying to get these laws passed. But now that it's in place, certainly you are seeing a lot of direct marketing.
Can we just have 5 seconds, 10 seconds left here. Can we put this genie back in the bottle? Can we demilitarize our police departments, Radley?
I hope so, but I'm not optimistic, unfortunately.
Yeah, this is something 800 times a week in the United States. Something that happened 30 years ago, so rarely it was virtually uncounted. 800 times a week, crash in people's doors. Radley Balco, the senior editor for Reason Magazine. You can read the whole article over at Reason.com. Radley, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
I got a window in the rear. I can see all around me many miles from here. I'm cruising along in my junkyard car, so I'm betting I just ain't going too far.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Terry O'Sullivan, the General President of the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA.org, is on the line with us. Hey, Terry, welcome to the program.
Thanks again for having me, Tom.
Labor Day coming up.
I'll tell you, 1 week from today, the day that that we recognize and honor the contributions that working people make to this great country.
You know, I think it's worth revisiting those because back in the 1980s, there were these major purges done during the Reagan administration of our high school civics textbooks and junior high school civics textbooks. The high school equivalents of David Horowitz with his campaign today to purge all things liberal from college campuses. They were very freaked out, the conservatives back in the day, that these communist or, you know, socialist teachers, because they were members of a union, were teaching stuff like the, you know, who's Joe Hill and what the Wobblies were and what about the Great Flint sit-down strike and, you know, stuff like that. And most of it got purged out of our textbooks. There's very little discussion about the real role and the real battles of labor from, you know, the Haymarket riots on down. In modern education, our kids graduate from high school not even knowing about this. So give us a quick thumbnail.
Well, look at it. Labor education needs to be expanded in this country. Actually, it needs to be talked about in this country. Most people don't recognize that if it wasn't for organized labor and workers banding together, that there would, you know, there wouldn't be a 40-hour work week or 8-hour work day. And the sacrifices and struggles of those that came before us that fought for the rights that workers have today is something clearly that we need to remind ourselves as Americans, and particularly appropriate on a Labor Day, but something, as you're right, Tom, that needs to be discussed in the grammar schools and high schools and colleges, so we don't forget that rich history that makes up the greatness of our country, and that's working people.
Right, and it's a relatively recent history, too, that built the middle class of the 20th century, and you could argue that it started in a very significant way coming out of some of the panics of the 1840s and 1850s. Abraham Lincoln was the first president to actually intervene to stop a corporation, or in this case actually a state that was cooperating with a corporation, from using their police force to break up a strike. And he said labor is superior to capital because labor precedes capital. You don't have profits until somebody's made something. And back in that day, right up through the 1870s anyway, that whenever there was a strike, the word strike was in quotes in newspapers. It was such a unique and rare thing.
It sure was. I mean, to me, Labor Day is a day that we as a country recognize that the most valuable asset that we have, Tom, isn't corporate America, and it's not Wall Street, that's working people. And I think it's also a chance for us to step back and also look at the major problems that are major challenges that are confronting working people in this country, whether it be the mortgage meltdown or how we elect a Democratic president in 2008.
How do you address, we're talking with Terry O'Sullivan, the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA.org. Terry, how do you address the criticism? And this was the debate that I had in the first hour of this program today with a conservative who was suggesting that labor unions have become less important, less increasingly irrelevant in the United States, in large part because of their declining influence and declining membership. And I had a rebuttal for that. I'm just curious what yours would be.
I certainly don't think that the power of organized labor has diminished at all, Tom. You look at 2006 election, you look at the power of organized labor when almost 26% of all those that voted were either union members or came from union households. I think the testament of how tough organized labor is what we've had to endure with this administration and with the Republican takeover in 94, although we got it back in 2006. I think that speaks to the power of the labor movement. And you see surveys that, these conservatives don't want to recognize of how many people, if they had the chance to form a union and didn't think that their employer would thwart it, would actually belong to a labor union, is as high now as it's ever been before.
And people who would like to join unions. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is that I had a caller call into our program in the first hour who said he was one of the over 30,000 Americans last year who lost their job because they tried to unionize their workplace.
And that's why we've been pushing for the Employee Free Choice Act, so where employers can't use threat and intimidations in union organizing campaigns to thwart a worker's or group of workers' will to form and join a union.
Right. And why we need to get a Congress elected that will stand up for it. And frankly, I was very disappointed that this Congress, when the Republicans said that they were going to filibuster the Employee Free Choice Act, and when Bush said that he was going to veto it, that they didn't raise hell in the Senate. Any idea why?
Well, I think that they're regrouping until for the next Congress to increase our ranks in both the House and Senate and get a Democratic president. We're going to keep pushing. Organized labor is going to keep pushing for the enactment and passage of the Employee Free Choice Act. And we're going to keep fighting to get a Build America candidate who believes in strong and safe infrastructure, accessible health care, fair and comprehensive immigration reform, freedom to form a union, and trade agreements which lift all nations rather than drive down the living standards for working people.
Yeah, well said. Terry O'Sullivan, the General President of the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA, LIUNA.org, the website. Thank you, Terry.
Thanks again, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Sinking like stones all around.
And a fine world it is, and we need to keep it, or it needs to keep us, actually, to maintain the web of life. But welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 866-303-2270, our toll-free number, coast to coast. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com or airamerica.com. Go to the Tom Hartman page. There's also a blog there, and there's a message board over at tomhartman.com, the blog over at airamerica.com. All kinds of ways to interact with us here. Stuart in Long Island, New York, on the line. Hey, Stuart, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, good to be on again. First, I want to thank you for playing Bon Jovi and the bumper music before. He's a very pro-union guy. He stood by my local, IATSE Local One's picket line at the Nokia Theater.
Great.
And also a great example of union leadership is UPS and FedEx. UPS is represented by the Teamsters. FedEx is non-union, but FedEx pays competitive wages because UPS is Teamster represented.
Yeah, and that was my point. I said, you know, when Reagan came into office, 25% of America had union jobs, but 50% of Americans had the equivalent of a union job, or, you know, half of them, 25% had union jobs, and another 25% had the equivalent of a union job, because the presence of the unions established the floor for the cost of labor. And that's a perfect example, Stuart, a perfect example of how FedEx has to pay their employees well and treat them well because UPS is a union shop, and therefore FedEx, in order to compete, has to maintain the same standards. Brilliant. Thank you very much for the call, and well said. George in Ventura County, California. Hey, George, what's up?
Tom, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to mention something about what President Bush said in 2001 about the British and the American intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Why has there been no hearings or investigation into the intelligence report? It's 100% wrong, and you would think they'd investigate that.
Which intelligence report?
In regards to Iraq having chemical weapons or weapons of mass destruction.
Oh, you're talking about the original intelligence that was used to lie us into a war, where we
exactly.
know from the British memo, the Downing Street memo, or minutes, or both. That in fact they were fixing the policy, fixing the facts to meet the policy, right? Fixing the intelligence to meet the policy. Yeah, there should be an investigation into that, and maybe there is. I mean, there are a lot of investigations going on in Congress right now. But you're right. You want a long list of impeachable offenses of high crimes and misdemeanors. That's right up at the top, in my opinion. George, well said. Thank you, Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I just recently turned 50 in the last couple of weeks, and I think my age is finally caught up with my age caught up with my cynicism here.
Okay.
I look at this thing with Gonzalez leaving and everything else, and early on I tend to look at things as to where the money is going and who benefits, you know, who's going to make the money. This whole thing looks to me like a giant heist, and now all the criminals are leaving Bush as the bag man. It's kind of like Ocean's 11. They didn't stick around to try to run the casino after they ripped the place off. And
yeah.
This is what I'm seeing. I mean, it just looks to me like, you know, they've stolen the treasury, run up a huge debt, and all the thieves are just kind of going off into the woodwork now. And nothing's going to happen. We know Bush is a lame duck. But we should probably concentrate our efforts on following the money as well. And the ideologues, they were useful idiots as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We do need to be following the money, and we need to be following the crimes, frankly. I mean, there need to be serious investigations into what this administration is doing and has done, particularly the crimes that have to do with war. The war crimes that Gonzalez was involved with, like torture and illegal renditions, and the crime of war itself. Preemptive war is a crime, according to the United Nations and according to the Geneva Conventions. We participated in that crime. We had the UN inspectors in there. You had Hans Blix in there saying, I got nothing. There's nothing. There's nothing going on here. We see nothing.
I'm not ever suggesting that they were sort of willfully and consciously lying, but I think that they wanted to jump to conclusions. I said in the Security Council that if something is unaccounted for, it doesn't necessarily mean that they exist. And I think there was that tendency to jump to that conclusion. We were there for 3.5 months, after all, and we did not find any smoking gun. And now that the U.S. has been, the U.K. had been there for quite some time, and they had the opportunity to interrogate people, they had had the whole cream of the Iraqi establishment in custody, and people should not be scared any longer to answer in the interviews. With this long period, I'm inclined to think that the Iraqi statement that they destroyed all the biological and chemical weapons which they had in the summer of 1991 may well be the truth.
Now, that was like 2.5 years ago Hans Blix said that. He was saying before we invaded Iraq, there's nothing here. We're looking all over the place. There's nothing here. Rumsfeld comes out and says, oh, we know exactly where it is. Hans Blix says, tell me, I'll go look, check it out. He says, no, you get out of the country because we're going to go start bombing them. That's a crime. It's an absolute crime. Andre in Columbia, South Carolina, listening on WIC 1230. Hey, Andre, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good. I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Hey, I was wondering with the Gonzalez events, his resignation, there's speculation that Chertoff may be, you know, handpicked for the situation. And I was thinking back about Chertoff. Doesn't he enjoy dual citizenship? Is he not?
Yes. He's both an Israeli and a U.S. citizen.
That's right. And shouldn't we reserve the highest branches of government for Americans? Just straight out.
You know, you raise a good question, and I suspect that if anybody, you know, objects to his being a dual citizen because it's Israel that he's a citizen of, and Israel is a strong and reliable ally of the United States, that people will push back by saying, oh, you're just being anti-Semitic. But I think that there is a larger issue here, and I'm certainly not, I'm assuming that you're not, but I think that there is a larger issue here of people who have dual citizenship. You know, should they hold the highest law enforcement position in the United States? And particularly when any country, all of our ally countries, are, you know, keeping an eye on us and us on them. So, you know, it's an interesting one. We'll see if it gets brought up. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTG. Hey, Gary.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. I'd like to share with you and your listeners, if I may quickly, words of wisdom from my political hero, the late Senator Edmund Muskie, and this is exactly what I believe is going on today with Bush and Cheney. And here's what he said in a nationally televised address. It was a long time ago, but I think it's exactly what's going on today. He said there are only two kinds of politics. They're not radical and reactionary or conservative or liberal or even Democratic and Republican. There are only two kinds of politics, fear, the politics of fear, and the politics of trust. And I believe that's hold very true today. We're living in the politics of fear, as you've noted many, many times before.
Yeah, and one of the things that I find very sad is that at least two of our Democratic presidential nominees are now sliding into the use of the language of the politics of fear in order to move their campaigns forward. And it frankly concerns me. The Republicans, of course, have completely embraced that dark side. But excellent point, Gary. Thank you. I was unaware of that quote from Ed Muskie, and it's brilliant. Steve in Eagle Creek, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Tom. I had a different take on what you were thinking about all these people bailing out of the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm.
If you look on the net, you'll find that somebody has bet $750 million that the stock market is going to drop 50% within the next 45 days. You can find this information real easy if you do if you run a search on SPY 750 and the 750 million and SPY and the
Well, hang on just a second. I would bet you that on any given day of the year there are $750 million worth of puts out there.
Okay,
puts are bets that the market is going to go down.
This particular put, if there isn't that drop, they lose the $750 million.
Oh, absolutely. But I'll bet there's also $750 million worth of calls out there. I mean, you know, there are constantly people betting on the future of the market.
I keep thinking in terms of the puts that were put out right directly before 911 happened.
And we still don't know where these things
are. Right, and nobody's talking either. And nobody in the Security Administration or Security and Exchange Administration will say who is the one that is betting $750 million that the stock market is going to take a 50% hit. Now, yeah. That's a lot of money to bet on taking a hit. My thought is that the only person that would know that would be somebody that was getting ready to start another war, specifically with Iran. If you knew that we were going to go and have a war with Iran, and you knew that in your heart of hearts, then wouldn't you be willing to miss or bet that much money?
No. No, not necessarily. First of all, I'm not sure that a war with Iran would crash the stock market that badly. Although, you know, it's hard to say, number one. And number two, as I said, I think, you know, any given day over the last 20 years, there's probably been $750 million worth of puts out there in the market and $750 million worth of calls. I am guessing that this is somebody who doesn't really understand how puts and calls work and how people bet on individual stocks or on the market.
They're going to lose an awful lot of money.
Yeah, and that happens all the time. I remember back when I thought I knew everything in the world, back in the late 70s, I went and I bought, you know, $200 worth of puts on GM, and I lost it all. So it would have been part of that $750 million. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
I want the truth from you. Give me the truth.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Yeah, let's start out with asking Mr. Gonzalez. Okay, why did you cover up George Bush's drunken driving conviction back when he was governor of Texas, for example? Why did George W. Bush get issued a whole brand new driver's license when he became governor and a whole new ID number so that all of his younger age records, like what was the crime that he was either convicted of or plea bargained out of that caused him to have to do 90 days of community service in Dallas? He writes about it in his autobiography, A Charge to Keep, as something that he simply just on an impulse decided to stop being a drunken frat boy and for 90 days, or maybe it was only 30 days, either 30 or 90 days, show up and help out in a homeless shelter in downtown Dallas. And then as soon as it was over, he went away. And, you know, Mr. Hatfield and others have suggested that he was busted for cocaine. Why is it that Texas issued an entire new driver's license and completely purged all records, all possibility of even finding records of the history of George W. Bush? Interesting. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mike in Jersey City, Jersey. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hello. Hi, Tom. I have one question to ask you. Politically, you're a socialist, right?
It depends on how you define it. I call myself a free enterprise liberal Democrat.
Okay, no, but sounds socialist but like because you're against corporation, everything. I want to ask
I'm not against corporations. I own a corporation. I've started seven corporations. I'm all in favor of corporations.
You're against General Electric, everything.
I'm not against General Electric. I think that corporations serve a vital and important purpose. I am all in favor of capitalism. I am in favor, however, of regulated capitalism. Now, in Sweden, they call that socialism. And so if you're saying, am I in favor of a system like they have in Sweden or in Norway or in Germany or in France, that they call socialist, then yes, I would say so. But if you're saying, if you're asking if I am in favor of socialism the way they define it in the Soviet Union, no, I'm not.
You're not, okay. But question, well, your prediction, when does this corrupted capitalism will change in this country for socialism? What do you think?
Well, you know, again, the word socialism is so loaded in this country because most Americans don't even understand what it is or what it means. I don't think it's a good word to use.
No, but I know what it means.
The larger question, I think the real question that you're asking is, when are we going to wake up and start re-regulating capitalism and go back to the way it was in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s before Reagan started the deregulation of the 1980s, which has wiped out the middle class? And I think that we're on the edge of it. And I think that, and I can tell you for sure, if John Edwards gets elected president and And possibly, if Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or any of the other candidates, Democratic candidates, get elected, but for sure, if it's John Edwards or if it's Dennis Kucinich, if either one of them gets elected president, you're going to see that kind of transformation in the United States. But and you're going to have a bulletproof majority in both the House and the Senate on the Democratic side. And that gets us back to Gary's call about the politics of fear versus the politics of hope and vision in the future, you know?
No, it means not never will be socialism in this country, no? We'll regulate capitalism. Okay, now another question. I'm very happy that Gonzalez is out because the Islamist freedom fighters in Guantanamo will be free, and now they can go all over in the world and do everything what they did before. What do you think, no? Guantanamo again will be free for... will be empty again from this.
Mike, I don't get it. I'm sorry. You're not making sense to me. So, Rafael in Playa del Rey, California. Hey, Rafael.
Hey there. How are you? Listen, I want to just touch on the fact that the gentleman before you had on spoke about militarizing our police department. You know, because of the concerns of the American military to try to get soldiers to participate in the military, you know, they've lowered their standards to such a level that it is a known fact, Mara Salvatrucha, which is the worst gang in the world, has had members. And we had a crime here, I don't remember if it was committed either in Orange County or in the Inland Empire, where a policeman was killed, and he was killed by one of these gang members who had military tactics. He used military tactics to kill him.
Well, the flip side of that is that in Iraq now, gang graffiti, U.S. gang graffiti is showing up in Iraq, apparently being put there by U.S. soldiers who are members of U.S. gangs.
Exactly. And that is really scary. You know, you not only you teach these people to kill, but then you teach them to kill with better skills. When they come back here, all hell could break loose.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Good point, Raphael. Thank you. Doug in Los Angeles. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Tom, first, let me worship you for a second. I saw The 11th Hour.
Yeah, isn't that a great movie?
Was blown away. Just blown away.
Yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio created a masterpiece. He really did.
Well,
and Lila and Nadia and all the folks at Tree Media and at Birkin Studios who are affiliated with it, they've created a masterpiece. By the way, there's an action page for that at 11thhouraction.com that you can check out as well. And there are other, really it's part of a movement. I mean, there's a movie called Crude Impact that talks about the issue of oil. There's a movie called The Corporation, which, you can Google a lot of this stuff and find all this stuff out there. There's just an enormous amount of stuff.
Well, what I wanted to ask you today was, what do you think the chances are that there is a connection between, the Democrats passing the Spy Act here a couple weeks ago, Rove's resignation and Gonzalez's resignation? Could there possibly be a deal that was cut somewhere?
Well, the only deal that I've heard of is that, and there's been no confirmation of this, is that Harry Reid said that he, in exchange for letting them go on vacation, that he would help pass the FISA Act, the Spy Act. And I think this was without realizing how toxic it was, in exchange for there being no recess appointments. And I think that probably that deal was made because we haven't seen any, and I suspect we won't. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Alex Epstein from Ayn Rand about the FDA. Should they be allowed to regulate drugs in the United States? Matt Stoller is here from Open Left, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.